enough for him to stop him from what is wrong. حجزته التقوى أن تقحم الشبهات. Such a person is so firm, is so strong that no doubt can affect his heart. No doubt can change the heart that he has to serve. As if Imam Ali is saying that, do you think that now that I've taken up this leadership and now that I'm saying these words that I will do what my duty is, I will be shaken by any form of doubts regarding what my duty is and what I should execute and what I should do? Nay, never. I am going to do that because I am a person who has understood, who has taken lesson from what has happened in the previous generations, and I am going to execute my duties in the best possible way. This is a leader. This is Amir al-Mu'mineen. This is the leader of the Muslim Ummah speaking. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال هناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
انظر كيف ضربوا لك الأمثال فضلوا فلا يستطيعون سبيلا
Look how they strike for you comparisons, but they have strayed, so they cannot find a way.
Brothers and sisters, we started talking about the 9th verse of chapter Furqan. انظر كيف ضربوا لك الأمثال فضلوا فلا يستطيعون سبيلا. And behold, how they strike similitudes for you, so they have gone astray and they will not be able to find the right path. You may remember prior to this verse, the unbelievers and the pagans tried to seek different pretexts and reproaches for Prophet Muhammad, and they argued against him, claiming, what kind of a prophet is this that is walking in the streets and in the the markets? He does not have an angel accompanying him to be a warner with him, or he does not have any treasures, and he does not have any gardens to eat of it. أو يلقى إليه كنز أو تكون له جنة يأكل منها. So this cannot be the true prophet we're seeking. In this verse, the 9th verse, however, the Quran says, انظر كيف ضربوا لك الأمثال. Behold, how they strike similitudes for you, but they have gone astray. فضلوا. In the previous program, we tried to talk about the answers to their pretexts and their arguments. And we said that it's not necessary for a prophet to be one of the angels, and it's not necessary for him to be accompanied by an angel. Of course, if he were an angel, the aim of giving people the practical examples in their lives would not be fulfilled. And he does not need the angel when he has a great miracle such as the Holy Quran. And by being in the markets, by being among other people and going to markets, this will cause him to associate with people more. This will make the people know him better, and there would be a kind of connection between them. على مر الزمان تألقا
وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter. حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا. The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The pagans should know that they are totally deviated if they think that having a kind of treasure means nearness to the Almighty Allah. So nearness to Almighty Allah does not depend on wealth and money. And the prophets have come all the way from the Almighty Allah to tell us that the value of man does not depend on the treasures and the wealth, but it depends on knowledge and piety. Furthermore, according to what kind of criterion did they call him insane and bewitched? According to history, his great revolution and his foundation of Islamic civilization were extraordinary. How can he be given such ridiculous labels? Unless we say that breaking idols and not blindly following the ancestors is a reason of insanity. So, let's refer back to the verse itself. Unzur, behold, كيف ضربوا لك الأمثال, how they strike similitudes for you. According to what we said, now it gets clear that the word amthal here, or similitudes, especially with regard of the context, means those groundless and meaningless words we talked about part of them in the previous verses. Using this word is perhaps because of the matter that they utter their words in the form of truth, similitude, and like logical reasons, while it was really not so. After all that, a question now arises, that why is it said فَلَا يَسْتَطِعُونَ سَبِيلًا فَضَلُّوا, but they have gone astray, فَلَا يَسْتَطِعُونَ سَبِيلًا, so they shall not be able to find a way to the truth. The answer is that man can find the path of truth if he wills, if he himself wants the truth. So, but the one who has already made decision by wrong and deviating prejudgments that originate from ignorance, that originate from stubbornness, not only does not find the truth, but also stands against the truth itself. There is one point regarding this verse to be discussed in the next program. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and
things always worked for me. When faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is your host Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet, and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Dear Sayyid, today we will again be talking about this very, very important and vast topic about how we should raise our children in an actual Islamic and correct manner. Last we mentioned that we needed to prepare an Islamic environment that is safe and nurturing and productive for our children so that they may grow in a good Islamic environment. And as part of this Islamic environment, we mentioned, for example, a good friend. Friends that they influence in a good manner our child, and vice versa. Dear Sayyid, what other things do we have to take into consideration when we want to raise our children in an Islamic manner?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. If you grow a garden and a farm with fruits and veggies and what have you, you would want to keep it safe from thieves and from people just walking past and taking
right.
from
pests
it,
and so on,
destroying right. it. So it needs a bit of protection and a guard,
of
right?
course. Right.
And this is what everything that has value, we guard it. So the most expensive diamond, it's going to be almost impossible to get to. Right?
Right.
The more money, gold, it's always locked up in safes right. that no one can access unless you're a thief.
The more so something is worth it, the more careful we are
exactly.
protecting it.
So we try to protect it, but there are thieves that could manage to sneak up on you.
Right.
Now, with religion and the faith of Islam being the most valuable thing in a person's life, because not only your life here depends on it, but your eternity on day of judgment also depends on it.
Right.
If you lose it here, you would have a very devastating result in the hereafter.
Right.
Right? So eternity in hellfire, God forbid. So to protect and guard our faith is extremely important. With kids, when we try to install Islam in their system and inject it in their system, we need to have a guard and an antivirus system that
right.
does not allow for people to come and steal that system.
Okay, immunity, and a barrier, a
yeah,
defense.
So you need to have a sort of protection.
Right.
Now, one of the means of protection is the fact that you get to know the dangers out there. Now, with any antivirus in this world, they have what they call an antivirus database.
Right.
What they do is they put all the names of the known viruses to date in that program, and that program, what it does, it uses this data that it has
right.
to search for anything similar in the system and says,
recognize.
Okay, now you have a problem.
Right.
Without this database file in that antivirus, we can't, the antivirus is useless. Same thing with our kids. If we want to protect them, we have to understand what dangers are out there.
And on that note, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@IRIB.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to raise our children in a Islamic manner. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
We were saying that parents need to have a system to protect the child, and right. First and foremost, they have to begin with identifying the dangers.
The first line of defense.
Yeah.
Right.
The first danger that we have to be aware of,
right,
and the first thief that we have to be aware of is the thief and the danger that we ourselves bring in and invite, and that is devices, screens.
Right.
Right. Now our kids, pretty much most of the time, they are home.
Right.
They have to be, or hardly they are playing, so they have to be facing one of few devices, either a mobile phone, either a tablet, or either a computer screen.
A laptop, computer.
Or TV. So it has to be one of these screens. And he's constantly on these screens.
Right.
The more they have screen time, the easier it is for anyone to manipulate their faith and steal their faith from them.
Right.
Or it's automatically just becomes less.
The probability.
The more kids watch nonsense and the more kids waste time, it becomes a habit.
Right.
This habit of wasting time, it will deprive them of their afterlife. So you know how the Imam says, "Iyyaka wad-dajari wal-kasal." I warn you from boredom and laziness, because one will deprive you this world, and the other one will deprive you the other world.
Right.
So just being lazy and bored. So the more they get into this habit of just being on screen time,
right,
that itself is a danger, right? Yet alone the contents that been pushed into their brains, be it through cartoons, be it sometimes through an ad. Sometimes now with YouTube, they're pushing a specific ad called Mafia City. I don't know if you've seen it.
Right.
With Mafia City ads, it's very destructive in nature.
Right.
It's only like 10-15 seconds ad. It's very destructive in its nature, but a lot of people think it's just a normal ad.
That's if the purpose of an ad, to be distracting.
If you analyze it, it's an ad for a game, but if you do an analysis to this ad, it's very destructive. And so on and so forth. So the kids get to see these things, even as an ad when they're watching their favorite program.
Said, of course, these promotional ads, you can find them everywhere in every single society. They always use some form of corruptive manner to pull the viewer in. Like in Western societies, often a female, also in Eastern societies for that matter.
Well, that's an idea of an ad. You would not make an ad if it's not appealing.
Exactly.
It doesn't attract people. And they put a lot of amount of effort and research into these ads.
Right.
Even psychologists sit behind these ads and make
it. Right. So it's a whole science.
Yeah. So marketing itself is a big study where people learn all these tricks.
Yeah. Right.
So me, I have to understand that sometimes with these devices, I give them to my kids as a gift. There you go. I got your laptop. I got your tablet.
It's disguised as a gift.
Yeah, so I give it to them as a gift. But I fail to take a precaution when it comes to these gifts,
right,
to these devices,
right,
that they're open to everything. Even in countries where a lot of things are blocked, now everyone has a VPN.
Right.
And kids have VPNs now.
Right.
The kids now, that, you know, they live in this age. They don't live in a different age.
Right. So if you want to sleep,
my son doesn't know about a VPN. Well, maybe he doesn't, but trust me, his friend would have told him already.
Right.
So you have to be aware that you have an open world in the palms of your child's hand, and that can deprive him of everything, sometimes even of his life.
Right.
Many people commit suicide because of that.
So to summarize, be aware that the gift that you're giving is not a Trojan horse, but an actual gift.
Exactly.
And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to raise our children Islamically. dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Therefore, we want parents to take extra care when it comes to handing these devices to their kids. Right. And now, especially in terms, because we're talking about religion, especially in terms of faith, now we have very smart, very cunning, very manipulative atheists.
Right.
And they have a way of talking. They have ways of trying to prove there is no existence of God.
Very good debaters.
Very good debaters. They're not very good. They're the dumbest people. But the
they know the art of debate.
They have the art of speaking.
Yes.
The art of talking. The art of convincing. They have that.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of Muslim kids fell victim to that.
Many.
So that deprives them. When a child comes and he says, well, I don't believe God exists. Well, we have a problem. We have a major problem.
A serious problem.
Yeah.
Right.
And how did that happen? It's because simply he was sitting on a device like this that I given to him.
Right.
And then he just lost it. So I have to be careful that what we give them, when we give them screen time, we have to make sure that it is used properly in a proper manner.
We need to monitor.
Or even sometimes when we talk about the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, I've seen many people who debate the concept of Imama or Esma,
right,
or the concept of the existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And there are those from other faiths who have also ways of debating.
Right.
And I could name a few names here, who are very cunning in the way they talk.
Yes.
And they, when if you listen to them, like, they make a lot of sense.
It makes logical sense.
Right. It makes you doubt your faith.
Right.
Right? So we have to be very careful that we don't open Pandora's box to our kids and say, oh, there you go.
Right.
But you have to be very careful.
Because they are completely unprepared to this. Mm. Even the average Muslim is unprepared to these things that are going around on the internet.
Exactly. Adults sometimes find it hard to cope because as an adult, my iman and my faith is a lot stronger. So even when I hear something I don't understand, I say, well, I don't know the answer. I don't buy it. I'm sure we have an answer for this.
We have a reasoning
for
this.
Yeah, but I don't, my faith does not shake.
Right.
But as a teenager, as a young boy, it really shakes up your faith.
It's the most impressionable age of a human being.
Exactly. So what we need to do is we need to make sure we have as less screen time as possible with our kids,
right,
which is sadly hardly done by parents. We need to give them less screen time. And when I say less screen time, I don't mean take the device from them or give them time limits. That doesn't work. Give them other activities to be busy with.
Like offer alternatives.
Offer alternatives. Take them swimming.
Right.
Take them out.
Yeah, fun activities. Right.
Take them out shopping. Take them with you to your friends. Take them with you to a holy shrine.
Right.
Take them with you on a trip.
Whatever. Just something
keep
sociable.
Keep them busy.
Right.
Right? You keep them busy away from the screen.
Right.
The more you put them in front of the screen, behind door, the more danger there is
for
our kids.
Is there say that the problem, in addition to this, is giving them privacy?
Too
much privacy.
It is. You're giving them privacy they don't require.
Right.
And now even, I heard one of the comedians making a joke about his daughter being locked. He says that I have a law in my house that no one should lock that door, and my daughter locks up her door, and so it's becoming not just a Muslim issue, but a non-Muslim issue. It's a common issue where kids locking up themselves in rooms, and we simply don't know what's going on.
Right. And on that note, dear Sayyid, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Shaheed.
Part 4.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Shaheed. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're going to be talking about the effects of the news of the general's assassination breaking out to people across the region and across the world. The first wave of emotions that people experienced across the region, again, and across the world was a state of shock for those who knew him especially. But there were people who didn't know about him or the effect that he has had on the peace and stability of the region. For those, they had a little bit of digging up to do. But once they went through that and realized what an influential character had been lost, they also went through the same state of shock, along with different stages of grief. But in this particular episode, we're going to be talking to one special guest to see how she went through the different stages of grief, because she felt the general's presence in her region with her flesh and bones. Joined right now by Marwa Osman, a journalist and political commentator. Marwa, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you. I'm going to start with my first question about a statement that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, said about the martyrdom of General Soleimani. He said that the martyr Soleimani is a lot more dangerous to his enemies than General Soleimani. How do you view that statement?
Thank you for having me. Sayyid Ali Khamenei's statement concerning the martyrdom of Haj Qasim Soleimani and how his martyrdom is way more dangerous than his actual life as Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani is the hit in the eye, the bullseye, to be honest with you. Why? Because if you haven't seen the millions of people who mourned and grieved Soleimani, not only during his funeral procession, but throughout the past 2 years,
oh, I have.
Whether in their homes, in their towns, in their studies, in their research papers, in their community service to their societies, then you can then understand that it was this man's martyrdom, this man's holy blood that was spilled, was the actual motivation for all of this work, for all of this jihad, fi sabilillah. It was some sort of an igniting force that gave the peoples of the world, not only the region, not only West Asia, but the peoples of the world, they gave them the motivation. It gave them the confidence to be who they are, to be the natives, the righteous people of their land, of their decision-making process, their right to decide their future, first of all, their present and their future for the next generations, and the right to make a new alliance with a force that, in my view, will most definitely be the power that will break the unipolarity of Western imperial powers in our region and elsewhere. So with this statement, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei is just presenting to us how this loss of hero, the resistance hero, was actually a victory. Even the way that he passed was a victory to the people.
All right, moving on to the reason why you are here. You came to Iran to attend the demonstrations and the second martyrdom anniversary of General Soleimani. How did you find the vibe on the streets? And do you see it? Do you see people ever forgetting, perhaps, the fire that they have right now?
Oh no, it's never ending. Never put out. The fire has never been put out.
Yeah.
We had a trip to Kerman to pay tribute to the shrine of Haj Qasim and his companions, and we visited his house that was turned into a masjid, and that was absolutely emotional for each and every one of us. We met Kermanis. We met people from Kerman who felt like the family, the direct family of Haj Qasim Soleimani. And we met even people in Tehran with different conferences that we attended at the Islamic cultural complex. And yesterday with Lady Zainab Qasim Soleimani at the Qasim Soleimani School, where it launched the first conference for scientific research, which is also very important because this is actually documenting the efforts and the victories and the achievements that were possible because of Qasim Soleimani, and how they will change and have changed the geopolitics and even furthermore the history of this region. When we talk about the emotional aspect of it, I can talk from personal experience. I came here thinking that it's going to be a nice trip, but once I got there, I stood in front of that holy shrine, I couldn't help myself. I was very emotional. I was very overwhelmed. I kept thinking that this man saved my life. This man kept my family. I'm sorry.
You know, while you try to continue your line of thought, maybe I can give you a little bit of my own experience with what happened, especially 2 years ago when it happened, and when I first turned on the TV and saw the helicopter filming the line of people. I can't really say a line of people, the flood of people filling Tehran from east to west, and I may not have gotten perhaps as emotional as you have gotten, because you mentioned that your family was saved because of him.
Yes, and it's not, these are not tears of grief. These are tears of, you know, that emotion that you have for someone, that love and passion that you have for an ideology or for someone, but at the same time you feel that you are unable to show complete tribute. You always feel that you are one step behind, that you're not really, you cannot fulfill. Yeah, you cannot fulfill what your heart and mind tells you. Mm-hmm. It was very overwhelming for me and for the group with me as well, because we felt directly in our everyday life the effect of Qasim Soleimani. It was not easy. You should have seen how Beirut and Dahiyeh turned into a military base. We had checkpoints at every entrance to Dahiyeh because we are having bombs on a regular weekly basis. And we lost a lot of family members, a lot of friends. We our security, our peace was taken away from us. We were threatened directly. I lost couple of my very dear students at the University of Ma'arif as well, who were fighting Daesh terrorism in Syria. So it is something very personal. And to be standing there in the hazrat of such an important person, yet such a humble person. He has such a humble characteristic, such a charisma that's so close to the people, to the public.
It's written soldier on his front.
Yes, it's just soldier. And this is what he wanted. And it teaches you. It puts you on the right track of truth in your own life. And it teaches you that wherever you go, whatever your achievements are, at the end of the day, you're just a soldier in the path of Karbala, al-Haq, the path of truth, righteousness, the path of resistance, the oppressed against the oppressor.
I'm going to give Marwa a short break here. I think she definitely deserves it. So let's take a quick look at how the media reacted to the assassination attempt when it happened. So, crippling U.S. sanctions didn't bring Iran to its knees. So what now? Well, over a year and a half after the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA and slapped those sanctions on Iran, it struck a strategic target, a human target, Qasem Soleimani. But if the strike was meant to be a cunning plan, it wasn't very cunning. Obviously, because it didn't bear a fruit load for the U.S. Early media reactions to the assassination of General Soleimani, many have implied a U.S. win and upper hand over Iran. David Wormser, senior U.S. National Security Advisor, had predicted in 2019 that the Iranians would welcome a military strike on a high-ranking commander such as Qasem Soleimani. But the reaction that actually followed? Millions poured out into the streets in Iran in protest to the killing of a soldier in command. And I'm not talking millions of plainclothes jihadist soldiers. Millions demonstrated in all shapes and colors, including women without a care for hijab or affiliation to Islamic rule. It was like a nation's reaction to a declaration of war, in that it united people of all walks and tendencies in their distrust for the U.S. To make matters worse for America, Iran attacked the Ain al-Assad U.S. base in Iraq in response shortly after the assassination. It was the first official attack on a U.S. military base since World War II, and it was precise. Analyses that followed said Qasem Soleimani was the most important figure in the fight against Daesh or ISIS and al-Nusra and all Takfiri groups. So by assassinating him, the U.S. only proved its own claims of wanting Daesh and Takfiri groups dead to be false. Next, as U.S. General McKinsey responded to a show host, the attack on Ain al-Assad proved that Iranian missiles are indeed precise. And what if Iran didn't have those precision missiles its JCPOA partners would so like to strip it of? Answer, Iran would be left with nothing but a lame diplomacy. So again, the Soleimani assassination only proved Iran's claim to be true, that without military clout paired with its diplomacy, this country would be vulnerable to military aggression without having any defenses. To make matters yet worse for the U.S., negative reaction to its act of terror went beyond Iran to Iraqi politicians and international legal analysts. Attack on U.S. forces increased in the region, and the Iraqi parliament was presented the legal means of expelling America on a silver platter. The very foundation of America's position in Iraq was crumbling, especially as several of Soleimani's companions were Iraqi, including another revered military man, al-Muhandis. The Iraqi foreign ministry wrote two letters to the UN Security Council chair and UN Secretary General complaining of a U.S. attack on Iraqi military strongholds, military commanders, and a high-ranking friend of Iraq on Iraqi soil. The American attack meant an attack on Iraqi rulership and went totally against conditions set on a U.S. military presence in Iraq. And on the 7th of January 2021, Iraq's judiciary issued an arrest warrant for former U.S. President Donald Trump for the murder of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Not every American official is naive or unable to admit to failure. Richard N. Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former American diplomat, tweeted that the U.S. strike had meant an end to the era of U.S.-Iraq cooperation and an increase in Iranian influence. Now, who gave America the key to the kill, the whereabouts of the general? France 24's Middle East Matters program heard IDF's international spokesperson Jonathan Conricus say the Israel military forces played no part in the killing of Iran's Qasem Soleimani, but the office of Benjamin Netanyahu, the then Israeli prime minister, did issue a short statement saying Israel stands with the United States in its just struggle for peace, security, and self-defense. Now that's interesting, as the U.S. had no proof or detailed allegation that Soleimani was plotting anything against it. And there was collateral damage, the deaths of accompanying drivers and security forces. The U.S. carried out an attack on the territory of a state, Iraq, without permission from that state. In fact, Soleimani went to Iraq on invitation of the Iraqi prime minister, and so said Mary Ellen O'Connell, a law professor and an expert on international disputes at the University of Notre Dame. Quote, "The attack was unlawful, the assassination was not justifiable," end quote. The premeditated killing of a specific individual commander for what they have done on the battlefield or what they may do has been prohibited by the law of armed conflict dating from the Hague Conventions of 1907 and by a protocol of the Geneva Convention in 1949. International war law aside, there has been a U.S. executive order in place since 1976 forbidding the U.S. from carrying out political assassinations. You can call it state terrorism. And here's what American and Israeli media outlets said about culpability. America's NBC, for one, said that Israeli intelligence had helped America with tracing Soleimani's trip from Syria to Lebanon to Iraq. The Jerusalem Post, on the other hand, wrote that two of the people who reported Qasem Soleimani's whereabouts, his comings and goings in Syria and Lebanon, worked for Mossad, the Israeli National Intelligence Agency. Welcome back. I have still a few more questions from our dear guest, Marwa Osman. So, this was straight up an act of terror. right? So, Iranian officials have repeatedly said that the retaliation is far from over. So they're still yet to come. But when that comes, how do you think, in whatever format it will, how do you think the international media as well as social media will respond to it, knowing that they can be forgetful at times?
When the retaliation started taking place, we all remember Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq, how it was brought down. It was carpet bombed with surface-to-surface missiles, and it was the first time that Iran showed this type of force. It actually showed it before, a couple of years back, when it bombed Daesh inside the Palmyra Desert of Syria, and it shocked the world. But the Ain al-Assad Air Base was a direct hit towards the enemy, and they kept denying that anyone was
injured, even
injured. But if you look at the reports coming out from the U.S. military, in the U.S. military over the forward coming months after the hit took place, you have more than 200 soldiers, personnel, who were either killed with friendly fire or killed in action or injured with injuries that are they can never come back from, because they don't have the audacity to they don't have the self-respect to actually say that we took a hit. That's how the empire works. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that the media doesn't show, and sadly our media is a bit weaker than the empire's media, and that's understandable, but we are doing our job as much powerful as we can be. But what happened is that Israel's top general, who was directly involved in the assassination, was killed at the age of 52, heart attack. Also, a U.S. general, one of the top U.S. generals in what they call the Middle East, in West Asia, was also killed with natural causes in Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. How were these people killed, who are directly involved with the assassination with General Qasem Soleimani and Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? So retaliation will never stop. And it doesn't have to be only at the level of personnel. It can be at the level of diplomacy. It can be at the level of military. It can be at the level of maybe weapon power.
Yeah, because they have no
arms power
that can even come close to the level of what we lost.
Because in international law, my friend, the assassination, the espionage and assassination against Qasem Soleimani equals the assassination of the chief of staff, or what is called as the highest rank in the American military force. Can you imagine if that ever happened to such a Western power, what they will be doing?
I can.
It is a terrorist, it's an act of terrorism. It's a crime according to international law. It's a crime according to Iraqi law. It's a crime according to Iranian law. It's even a crime according to U.S. law itself.
Yeah.
But they see themselves as above the law, but our region does not even see them. That's why we resist them. We don't fear them. If we feared them, we wouldn't have the likes of Qasem Soleimani fighting them.
Yeah. So following that same train of thought, Iran has repeatedly also mentioned that it would take legal international action against this act of terror. What do you think the correct step-by-step measure would be for Iran to actually be able to manifest something out of this legal pursuit?
Well, we had a debate the other day about that, whether or not this will give out any results, whether real results will come out from this legal aspect of pursuing to put on trial the people who were behind the assassination, everyone who was behind the assassination, those who took the decision and those who implemented. To begin with, we don't trust international law. We don't trust the UN. We've seen how they... it's all textbooks, nice textbooks, very well-written...
They show concerns.
Yeah, very well-written laws that are never, ever applied by the major powers. So we don't have trust, but we have hujja. We have we need an evidence in our hands, not only on the battlefield, but in the hallways of the justice system, despite the fact that we do not trust it, but it doesn't mean that we should not be there. We should be there. Iran is a member of the United Nations, it's a member of the UNSC, and it has every right to speak up and say that this was not a wrongdoing, this was an assassination, this was an act of war. Iraq has a right to do the same, and every nation in this world has a responsibility towards what happened, because this can happen to it as well, to its members, to its people. So it's part of not only solidarity, but it's a right to protect the sovereignty of nations, the independence of nations, and to abide by international law.
Let's move on to 5 days after the assassination, and when the when Iran carried out the ballistic missile attack on the Ain al-Assad airbase. In the beginning, there was little to no coverage, or even if there was coverage on international media, it was watered down quite a bit.
Yeah.
But after on, they kind of had to do their due diligence, if you want to even call it that, and start talking about the actual casualties, even if, again, still very much watered down. How do you analyze the reaction during, like, immediately after the attack, and also as time went on?
Well, let me tell you first what happened in Lebanon when the retaliatory attack by Iran happened. If you have been to Lebanon during New Year's Eve, you would understand how we celebrate. We are crazy people. We celebrate hard. We celebrated New Year's 5 days before that. Mm-hmm. And then on the fifth day of the assassination, after all the grief and the anger, when the retaliatory attack happened, it was non-stop celebrations all across Lebanon. It was fireworks, gunfire.
Wow.
We're crazy people when it comes to celebrations. It was something that hit hard. It was like something that we've been waiting for more than 40 years. 40 years. We've been under this oppression, an aggression of the Zionist entity held by the hand of the United States of America. It was a revenge for every one of us. It was a revenge for Syria. It was a revenge for Sana'a. It was a revenge for Baghdad. It was a revenge for Tehran and every street in Tehran that was attacked by the Mossad. It was for every martyr that has fallen at the hands of this imperial power. It was a time for us to stand, put our heads high and say, we, the people of the world, under the patronage of the Islamic Republic of Iran, have the power to retaliate. We can stand high and say, you cannot step on us anymore. We have the power to stop you. This is how immense the situation was. But talking about the how the Western world actually covered or uncovered the situation that was happening, the retaliatory attacks, they tried very hard to suppress and hold back any kind of news that's coming out of the of the region. But we live in the age of the now, the real-time reporting. And social media is a very important tool, despite the fact that they control it. But it's a very important tool if you know how to manage it. The videos that we got from the soldiers themselves who were shooting the time when the ballistic missiles fell, they were priceless. Priceless. Their screams and squeaks and cries and please, oh God, help us. Who's going to help you now? This, you are feeling what we have been feeling for the past 40 years.
A taste of your own medicine.
Yes, it's the first time a bomb falls on your head, dear soldier. Well,
boo-hoo.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Marwa, for sharing us your side of the story. It's always a pleasure when you see somebody else going through a similar, very different, but in a way similar experiences when we're talking about the assassination of Marzia Soleimani. It was also definitely very nice for me to be able to share my experience with someone that went through, again, similar but very different experience as I have. So that's going to do it for this part of the program. Let's wrap up the show.
Those who take on great responsibility rarely have time for their families. Haj Qasem Soleimani, though, was among those who find time for family, especially their parents and children, to the best of their ability. He spent every given moment to visit his parents as long as they were alive, showing respect by kissing their hands and feet. He believed their prayers and piety were one reason why God provided for his livelihood via his service to Islam and Muslims and the oppressed of the world. He believed the road to salvation and happiness in life and the afterlife was kindness to and appreciation for one's parents
as a form of thanking God. He wrote to his nephew, "Dear Matty, respect and humbleness before elders, especially your parents, are a must. Make it a habit to kiss your mother and father's hands without inhibition, as this will both make them happy and affect you and your life positively." Marta Pur Jafari, his companion for years, says, "When his mother was hospitalized, Haj Qasim kept on kissing her and weeping. Dear mother, forgive me for not being a good son to you. Forgive me for not doing my duty to you, as I should have." Apart from parents, attention and care for his wife and the upbringing of his children were a top priority to him. The martyr's brother says, "He adored his children and brought them up to be followers of the leader of the revolution and lovers of the Prophet's household. During their education, he tried to visit their place of study at least twice a year to see how they're doing. He loved his children. However, he wouldn't allow them any economic activity by misuse of his name and position."
In this episode of The Shaheed, we focused on different aspects of the effects that the martyrdom of General has had on people's lives, as well as how it was reflected on mainstream media, as well as social media, and the support that the General had gotten from the people, especially the oppressed people and the freedom-seeking people of the world and the region. Take care. Bye-bye.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
فدعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانا يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على فاطمة وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها وسر المستودع فيها بعدد ما أحاط به علمك. اللهم كل وليك الحجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى آبائه في هذه الساعة وفي كل ساعة وليا وحافظا وقائدا وناصرا ودليلا وعينا حتى تسكنه أرضك طوعا وتمتعه فيها طويلا. Dear Muslim brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Habibullah Fasihizada with the Let's Recite the Quran, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International School Network. You're hearing us today, inshallah. As you hear us, we are going to continue our previous sessions talking about how to read the Holy Quran. Like, we are going to practice, inshallah, the fluency, the reading, the correct reading of the Quran, okay, which we call Ruhani and Rawanhani. I am very, very happy that I have again our friends, four of our students from Sevier International School, that inshallah one by one I will tell their names. Mr. Hadi is there, Hadi Naghavi, and Mr. Yes, Hadi Naghavi?
Yes, Sayyid Muhammad Hadi Naghavi.
Sayyid Muhammad Hadi Naghavi and
Sayyid Muhammad Yahya Ja'fari.
Okay, Sayyid Muhammad Yahya Ja'fari and
Minhal Hussein Nasser.
Okay, Minhal Hussein Nasser and the last friend
Mahdi Al Husseinan.
Mahdi Al Husseinan, right? So Mahdi Al Husseinan, Alhamdulillah, has joined us from Canada, and Minhal Hussein from Pakistan, right? And Muhammad Yahya?
Iran and
Iran and Pakistan,
Iran,
right?
And Pakistan.
India?
Kashmir.
Kashmir, okay. He has joined us from Kashmir. And Hadi?
Pakistan.
Pakistan. That's great. That's great. Alhamdulillah. Different nationalities, but we are friends because Quran has joined us. Yes? All together. Alhamdulillah. So, dear Muslim brothers and sisters, as you remember, we were practicing the alphabet letters at the very, very first sessions. And then we continued up to the next lessons, which were talking about Fatha, Kasra, and Dhamma. I mean the harakat, the short vowels. And then